I love sport
because of its purity, of its simplicity.
But it gives you a sense of identity, whether you as an individual or as a nation.
And that's why we love sport.
You're listening to Falling in Sport with your host, Mzamo Moloi. Before we get started, I thought it best to explain the why for the series. Somewhere along the way, a lot of us fall out of love with sport. Whether we're disenfranchised, disillusioned, or we're forced to grow up an adult and told to stop playing FIFA. Hashtag true story. But what the coronavirus pandemic and subsequent lockdowns has done is actually pique people's interest in sport again, even if it's just as a pastime. I've been working in and around sport for almost a decade now, and I found myself falling out of love with sport. A truly weird space to find myself in. But as lockdowns have eased up around the world, people have taken this as an opportunity to rethink and reset what's important, or not. Similarly with sport, I've been thinking, what if this is an opportunity for us to decide what we fall in love with? This is a podcast about falling in love, one sport at a time, to remind ourselves why we love sport. It's part narrative, guest-oriented. You'll hear voices of actual sports fans, and maybe some things you didn't necessarily know. No need to have been the one who played for the first team at school to listen either. This is also for those who never got to play, because sport at its most basic level is an exercise in hope. And we could do with more of that right now. In this first outing, we're talking cricket. Why? Because South Africans love cricket too. Plus, would have been too obvious to begin with football. We'll get to it, trust me. In this episode, award-winning coach Geoffrey Toyana tells us about the sport that saved his life. And I catch up with cricketer Solo Ngweni on his battle against an autoimmune disease. And with that, let's fall in sport.
This game called cricket had its origin in quiet places and lives on in equally quiet places, deep in the hearts of those who love it.
One of my most vivid cricket memories is from the mid-1990s. I grew up in Orlando East, and like any kid from Soweto, I played in the street, well, most of the time. I'm not sure if the Proteas were playing a series, but what I am sure of is me and my friends playing street cricket with two beer crates, a makeshift bat, and a tennis ball. But what sticks out the most about this memory is that mid-game, a flying squad car pulled up. The flying squad was the closest South Africa ever got to a rapid response police team. Remember, this was the mid-90s. And the advent of democratic South Africa had happened just the other day. Now from that squad car came out two white officers in full bulletproof vests and guns. What did they want? To play cricket, of course. Incidentally, Coach Geoffrey Toyana is also from Orlando, though he never quite played with the cops.
Yes. I mean, I grew up in Soweto in Orlando East, like the late 80s. We're very, very tough. You know, and police will come and just chase us for nothing. And it was one of those things that when you saw, like, that police big car, which we used to call hippo.
Yeah.
It just come and, you know, like, you have to run, you know. And then I was caught one day, and then I spent about an hour there. I think as a 12-year-old, I mean, I spent an hour at the back of that hippo.
Ooh.
You know, and it was not pleasant. But, yes, here we are.
Geoffrey has won every accolade a coach can hope to win in the South African cricket franchise system. South African cricket as a whole is under the spotlight at the moment, and most media conversations with Coach Toyana tend to go straight to that. But we're going to avoid the low-hanging fruit for now. I want to start off this conversation with you on a lighter note.
Okay.
Your nickname is GNT. Right. Is this true?
Yes.
This is
true.
Yeah,
that's true. Like that comes from my initials, Geoffrey Richardy, G, and then Toyana, so GT.
GT.
So GNT, yes.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
Okay. So now, linking back onto my memory about my most vivid cricket memory, I want to ask you a question.
of our series of questions. Where were you when the Australians call it the miracle? I don't think we call it that. Where were you when the Proteas lost the 1999 Cricket World Cup semi-final against Australia?
Oh, jeepers. I was still playing for Gauteng at the time. And I remember it so well because I was staying with a good friend of mine, Johnson Maffa. We were staying in Bears Valley, you know, like, and we watched the game on TV. And yeah, it's heartbreaking. Like Lance Klusner, you know, like it pulled us out of trouble in a few games before that. I can still remember Hansi Kroonier, like, and Bob Uma with those mics, you know, like that they had with them. So like that World Cup just brings those type memories. I mean, Herschel Gibbs catch, which I still believe, you know, it was a catch.
Yeah.
But but I mean, you know, like that one run, you know, and with still a few balls, you know, to spare, and Lance Klusner playing so well on the day. Yes, I was with Johnson Maffa, and we nearly broke our TV.
You know, tell you what, you may have almost broken your TV. I remember crying, going onto my mother's bed and crying.
Yeah, it was a tough one.
Where were you when South Africa pulled off the 438-run chase against Australia?
I was at the Wanderers.
Oh,
but,
wow.
But, you know, yes, but I left halfway through.
Oh.
I mean, I saw that now, like the Aussies, were killing us, you know, like as the score went past 400, I thought, no way, no chance, I'm going home. And then I went home and then halfway, because at the time I was staying close to the Wanderers. Then as I got home, I mean, like I saw Herschel Gibbs, you know, and Graham Smith at the time, like we're playing a few shots, you know, I think halfway after 25 overs, I think we're over 200 or something. And then I was still with my good mate, Johnson Maffa, and we decided to drive back, you know, to the Wanderers because we did have passes, you know, at the time, because we were there at the Wanderers. So it was easy to come in and out. Yes. And we saw the end of it. I mean, like the last 100 runs also, like we saw that special game. Like Makai Antini to third man there.
Yeah.
You know, like that was really, really something special. I mean, Herschel Gibbs, I mean, like he was unbelievable, you know, in that game. So very, very good memory, you know, like of South African cricket. And also like it brought everyone together,
it did.
You could see black and white. I mean, we're so excited. There were the people crying in the stands. I mean, it was a very, very special day. And I'm still having some, like a goosebumps.
As you're talking, I'm experiencing it right now.
As I'm talking. Yeah.
Okay. And to round off my questions of where were you, I preface this with that Coach Toyana is a Twitter troll in that he is fast becoming my favorite person to follow on Twitter. His meme game is on point. When Kaizer Chiefs plays, when Kaizer Chiefs loses, Coach Toyana is there. He's there, subtweeting. People are, you're amazing. You're really my favorite right now. So I want to know, where were you when Sundowns won the CAF Champions League? And how did you respond to that?
Jeepers, I was so, I think we were driving back from Kimberley. I think I was still coach of the Lions. And then we were sitting on the bus because like the game was late, I think.
We were sitting
on the bus. I still remember sitting with Stephen Cook and Neil McKenzie, I think. Guys like Kahiso were like on the bus because we played a 4-day game in Kimberley.
Okay.
And then we drove back. You know, like all our phones were dead at the time, and then like we didn't get you know, like that information like that we wanted. Then as we got off the bus, I mean, I got into my car and then I heard that Sundowns had won the game. I mean, I was so excited because I was there, you know, for the first round of the game, I think. Yes, I was there, like at the first round game.
Yeah.
And then us going, you know, away and winning it that side. I mean, wow. Like that was a special, special, special day. I love Sundowns. I've always loved Sundowns. And then growing up as well as a township guy, you know, like I thought I was going to play for Sundowns growing up, but that thing took, you know, like a 10, and then I ended up, you know, playing cricket.
My favorite cricket memory has to be from 2003, when South Africa was hosting the Cricket World Cup. The Proteas were practicing in Benoni at Willowmore Park. And at the time, I was one of the Eastern's junior players. And we were called to come and bowl to the Proteas in the nets. So that was truly memorable.
South Africa played Pakistan, and I remember being at the Wanderers, and Quinton de Kock had such an amazing game. It was a Thursday night, I even remember, and he was on top form. And my favorite part of it was because him and AB de Villiers, AB was still mentoring him at that time, and he was just, Quinton had played such a magnificent innings. But then after the game, because he still kind of wasn't media trained, Quinton and AB were like literally sitting shoulder to shoulder, and every time Quinton would give us like a 5-second answer, like AB would be like, no, add more words, give us more context. So I think just that game itself, it was Quinton's home ground at the time because he was still with the Lions. Him kind of finding himself within that team, establishing himself as a leader within the side.
It's definitely the 438 game, not just because it was such a phenomenal game of cricket, but also as a first year in varsity in Res. And in Res, as first years, you weren't allowed to have a TV in your room or on your corridor. But a couple of guys had TV cards in their computers and laptops. And I remember about 50 of us crammed into this tiny single room, just stuffed in there like stars, sardines, enjoying those fantastic final few seconds. And it was just such a great vibe when Bouch hit those last runs.
Take a trip to Orlando East in 2020, and you still won't find a cricket ground in the football-obsessed township. From wannabe footballer in the late 1980s to being a cricketer is a big leap, considering the lack of facilities even back then. So I guess the question is, why cricket?
My dad, he's an ex-cricketer.
Okay.
He was very, very sporty. He played for the Black 11 in the 1970s and 80s. So I still remember as a kid, I think I was 2 years or 3 years old, you know, like when my dad left for cricket, you know, I used to drive on with him in my underpants, you know, and just go to the games. And my mom will always complain and say, you know, at least take some trousers. Then I'll just go with my dad, I mean, from 8 o'clock in the morning, and then we come back around 6, 7 at night.
Wow.
I mean, like, that's what I used to enjoy. I think I was 2, 3 at the time. And then, as any township boy, age 10, 11, 12, started playing soccer, you know, age 14, 15. Like, I've played for every club, basically, in Orlando East, you know. And then I went to trials as well at Jomo Cosmos, because Jomo Sono is from Orlando.
Yes.
So his club was just around the corner. So to go to trials there, I was a defender.
Okay.
Like, I was not too bad. Like,
okay.
My nickname was Bricks.
Ah, you know, like, was Bricks. Zones.
I used to call me Bricks. And then, yes, you know, like, as you know, playing in the townships, you know, like, I started to smoke when I was still, 15, 16. So I started to get into trouble, you know, like, and my dad picked this up quickly. And then he gave me like an ultimatum, basically, because he tried before, like with his other sons, and like that his sons must play cricket, because he was very sporty. I mean, he played baseball and he played cricket as well. So, yeah, so like he saw that I was getting into trouble. And then he basically told me that if I want to stay like in his house, you know, like I must go play cricket or else I mustn't stay in his house.
That ultimatum went a long way into shaping who Geoffrey Toyana has become. With the bit of talent he says he had, Toyana went on to make the Coca-Cola under-19 side of the then Transvaal. But that early success was mixed with financial difficulty, challenging his very dedication to the sport. Many a time, his family having to choose between buying bread or using that same money to send him to training.
So it was that tough, and then, you know, I persevered. I mean, you know, I kept going. You know, I knew I had talent. I matriculated at Orlando High in 1993, you know, but like there was no money at home like to take me to university. And cricket, you know, like was my way out in a way, because I matriculated in 1993. And then in 1994, like I was invited to Lords, you know, like
wow.
In England, you know, as part of the MCC. You know, like young cricketers, where players from all over England, you know, like I selected. And then, you know, it's like an academy type thing. So, like, I went there. I spent 6 months there. You know, like, I had a good time there. And I was close to signing as well for Sarri at the time. You know, but I was still a young Soweto boy, you know. I missed home. You know, like, I wanted to go back home and eat a makwinya, you know, snogfish and those type of
you
things.
Prefer,
you know?
You prefer fish and chips? I mean, come on.
Yeah, you know, Kasi boy and Kasi mentality. Yes, I came back and then I played a bit for Transvaal B. And then, then I got my first contract, you know, at Transvaal at the time. I played Transvaal B mostly in 1995, 1996. And then, yes, since then, you know, I've not looked back. But growing up, it was not easy. Like, you're coming from Soweto where, like, there's no facilities. Like, there's no cricketing schools.
What were the perceptions? I'd imagine, because like we said before, Soweto is a football community. What were the perceptions of the game where you were growing, Orlando? What was it like for other kids? And then how was it amongst adults? Because you say your father played. So what was the attitude towards cricket? And even in that time, who were your heroes?
Like, the perception and the people there at the time, like, they were just thinking, you know, like, these kids with big bags, I mean, like, what are they doing? You know, like, they're playing, you know, the white man's sports. I mean, I still remember, like when I went to grab a taxi, you know, like, at the station in Orlando, close to the police station there, you know, like, with my big bags, and I'll catch abuse from people around. Hey, Anticronier. You know, like, there was no cricket there. Like we didn't have any heroes.
Yeah.
You know, like, only my dad was pushing me on the side. And, you know, like, there was nothing. I mean, like we had to start it up and take those insults at the time. I mean, like, there were gangs in my Kasi. I mean, like, Ikabasa, like, at the time, was terrorizing, you know, Orlando East. Then we'll come with those big bags and they'll ask us, have you got AK-47s? I mean, what's going on? Where are you going? You know, it wasn't easy, but we persevered, you know. And, like, there were so many talented players, like, that we never saw because, like, they did not persevere. You know, the talent guys were more talented than me. You know, the guys with, like, natural skills. Yeah, but we never saw those guys. And I know them. I can name them. You know, it is quite sad what's happened, you know, at the time, like, for us. And it's sad now, like, when you see that there's still no facilities in the townships. It's got challenges in the township. Our kids are into Nyaope, you know, like, our kids are into challenges, like, you know, and because, like, there's no, you know, fields or places where kids can play.
Sure.
You know, I, for one, you know, I was saved by cricket because if I didn't play cricket, you know, either I'll be dead now or I'll be in prison because all my friends ended up dead or in prison.
Now, you were predominantly, you're a batsman in your playing days, for the most part.
Yeah.
And you were to describe batting to someone who's only ever been a spectator and they never got to wield the willow, as they say, what was your favorite thing about batting? Is it the sound of the ball off the bat? Was it just being there imposing your will on bowlers? But what was that thing that was like, I love doing this?
Yeah, just for me, I mean, growing up, I mean, yes, the facilities were tough. I mean, there was times we're training in bad conditions. Like, that's why, you know, it's tough to get black batters strictly from the township to go through and play first class cricket because it was tough. I mean, the places we train in. But for me, you know, the biggest thing I love with batting is something that I learned very, very late in my career. You know, like, when I was still playing.
Okay.
And, like, that you spend time, you know, at the crease. Just stay there. Stay there at the crease. Bet on, you know, on ball and those type of things. You know, like, that's what basically for me, like, that bet, you know, like, on ball, going qua. You know, for me, like, that's what I love about betting. And also, like, when there's a fast bowler, a guy who bowls quick, you know, a guy who wants to hurt you, and you fighting it through there.
Yeah.
You know, for me, like, that's, you know, like, special. I've had my battles with fast bowlers as well. Guys like Alan Donald running in, wanting to kill you. And you're fighting through, like, those processes. You know, like, it was like something, you know, nice and something special.
I love cricket mainly because there's just so many factors involved. It's literally not just about the bat and ball. If the wind blows in a certain direction, if the screen irritates a bowler, if the fans are a little too loud, if you throw in a little bit of abuse, all of that comes into the picture and kind of creates, whether it's Test cricket, ODI or T20, it creates this cauldron of excitement where every little thing matters. Nothing is taken for granted when it comes to a game.
It's just such a beautiful all-round sport. Tests you emotionally, physically, mentally. You know, it's about being able to concentrate for 5 days, being at the top of your game, and then just absolutely bringing the flair for 2 hours or 20 overs. It's not just about bowling an in-swinger now, it's about setting him up so that when that out-swinger comes, you get the outside edge, or rotating the strike and then hitting the boundary at the perfect time of the over. It's like chess for champions.
Because as much as it's a team sport, there's so much dependency on individual skills or talent. If you're a bowler, running up to, I don't know, take a wicket, curb the runs, no one else has that ball in your hand. You've got to do your job. If you're a fielder under a high ball, for instance, waiting to take a catch, that could end a big batting partnership. Or if you're a batsman trying to save a game, so much depends on the individual, but it's also a beautiful team sport.
G&T's love for the game shines most through his desire to mentor talent. He did this at the Lions as head coach for over 5 years, and now as assistant coach at the Titans. So, coach, who are you most proud to have seen take the next step?
Oh, stupid. That's a tough question.
Well, maybe give me a top five. Okay. Give me a top five.
Yeah, for me, I mean, obviously, guys like Temba, you know, coming through. You know, a guy like Vian Mulder for me, who I played at the Lions when he was still doing grade 12. Sure. I mean, like he was in matric. And then within a year, I mean, he was playing for South Africa. For me, like, that's really, really like something that I'm proud of. And going back to Temba, him getting that Test 100, you know, like at Newlands, I mean, like, it brought tears to my eyes. I mean, but because I've seen his hard work. Temba used to come at the Wanderers at the time, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, indoor center. Like the two of us, you know, just throwing balls, you know, like in the bowling machine for days and days. And for him to come through as well and get that 100, you know, at Newlands was really, really something special. And a guy like Stephen Cook, I mean, you know, he scored runs, scored lots of runs, but he was not getting his opportunity. But that's the guy, you know, who never gave up, kept going. And I think at age 34, I mean, he got his chance finally to play for South Africa, you know, and he got a, you know, Test 100 on debut, you know, at SuperSport Park. Like, those memories for me, really, really special. I mean, a guy like Quinton de Kock,
yeah,
you know, who I've known since he was 16 years old, you know, for him to be the Quinton de Kock that he is today. You know, I've seen his work. I've seen him at the one run from 9 o'clock until 2 o'clock, just hitting balls. You know, like, that makes me really, really proud. I mean, Pangiso, Eddie Lee, Brent Pretorius, you know, guy like Rassie van der Toosen. You know, for me, like it's a mixture, you know, of all those players, like, that makes me proud. I mean, like I'm proud of them, and I'm not taking any credit, like, yes, like, for their achievements. Yeah, but because, I mean, you know, it is like they're like hard work. Like, they've put in the work, you know, and they've got the rewards. And, like, that's what makes me, you know, very, very, you know, happy. I mean, like Alviro Peterson as well. I mean, you know, it makes me, like, very, very happy.
Going into this episode, I was tempted to sidestep the current discourse in and around cricket in Mzansi. But that would be naive. The uncomfortable conversations about equality and representation in South African cricket must happen and should continue. And I thank and acknowledge those leading this necessary conversation, including the first black African head coach in the South African franchise system.
There were, like, injustices, you know, like of the past, which were done to people. Mm-hmm. And people are coming out now, like to speak about those things. But like, the perpetrators, you know, of those things, you know, like, are not taking accountability, which for me is something that's going to take us backwards. You know, we must be, you know, accountable and take responsibility, you know, of what's happened in the past. Like, there is no doubt. I'm like, I was part of those 40 ex-coaches and cricketers where each and every one of us have our own stories. If we can't all tell our stories, you know, it will take our cricket down. But for me, it's good that we are telling stories. That's the lessons like that we need, like, for us to move, you know, in a positive way. And also, the biggest thing, like, those players, like, that, the biggest thing that I think that we're looking for, you know, until we don't want favors and we don't want revenge. All we want is equality. Up until we can get that right, we can move forward. Because at the moment, like, it is in big trouble. There's a lot happening. And I dread to think what the players in the system at the moment, you know, are thinking. And because I think the blessing in disguise that we are under COVID now, as you just imagine if there was a test series being played, you know, in this climate at the moment, you know, it was going to be just chaotic. So for me, I think, like, this is the time for us, you know, like just to reflect, you know, and sit down, you know, in one room and iron out this thing and make sure that we put cricket, you know, at number one.
With that in mind, two things can be true at the same time. We want to see South African cricket with opportunities for all on an equal playing field. It's not at the moment, and that must change with all stakeholders being involved. And at the same time, we still want people to keep playing the game, if not now, when it's safe to do so again. When the coast is clear, we want previous, present, and future generations of South Africans to enjoy cricket. And one person who's adamant to enjoy his cricket again is Solo Ngweni. In 2019, at age 25, the all-rounder went from a healthy physical specimen to literally being a shadow of himself within a matter of months. While Guillain-Barré syndrome may have put a pause on his life and career, he's intent on pressing play again. Solo, over the last couple of months, I've seen the content you've posted online. It's almost like a journal of your ongoing recovery. And after each post, I've come away thinking I've taken so much for granted in my own life, like being able to take a simple step.
So, you know, look, it's two things. One, obviously, I didn't have a lot of the content since my phone.
Yes.
And two, I was still getting to a point where I was, like, comfortable with showing myself in this way.
Sure.
You know? Because for some time, even when I looked in a mirror and I saw myself, you know, while I was doing therapy, I couldn't sit in front of a mirror because I couldn't believe how drastically I had changed.
Yeah.
You know, and I was struggling with accepting that for a long time. But I just think, you know, things happen naturally, and eventually one day I was just like, you know what, you know, let me just put it out there, because so many people are asking about where I am, how do I feel, how do I look, what's it like? And I just felt like it would give people a better idea about where I was and where I've been. And also, like I've mentioned to you, it formed it as a form of therapy for me, you know, in that even now when I go through some challenges or feel like I'm not really progressing as fast as I would like, I look back and I see the journey and I see that, okay, there are points in the journey where it's been worse. And in my mind, I never knew how I would even get out of that particular situation. But eventually I did, you know. So, yeah, it's been quite hectic.
Quite the journey.
Yeah. And look, even me, before this whole thing happened to me, I was probably the same, you know. I just went on with life, like I was saying, chasing goals and maybe neglecting the simpler things or empathizing with people that have different challenges to what I had, you know. And maybe this was why I'm going through this, you know, to be able to appreciate the simpler things. And, you know, with GBS, it's so interesting that this disease is like the only neurological disease that you get better. The other ones, sure, you deteriorate, you know. So it's crazy. It's like I will eventually get better. It's just going to be one hell of a process. And me going through each stage of this process truly has, you know, made me appreciate those simple things. I mean, there was a stage where for 3 to 4 months, I wasn't able to talk, drink, eat. You know, the way we communicated, I had a board with letters A to Z, and I would have to blink on the letter, you know, to try and spell words, you know, and that would take 10 minutes to just get one word. You know, stuff like that. Yeah. Like, I used to have dreams of drinking water, just drinking water.
Oh,
literal
that is perspective,
dreams,
guy.
You know, and you are, it's so amazing when you're just able to get to that point where you can do these things, you know. Like, truly, it's crazy. Like, when I had to learn how to talk again, you know, from scratch. And it's just amazing how the human body is actually set up on the inside. You know, it totally fascinates me, and I had no idea before. Like, so you don't have to feel bad about, you know, seeing me going through what I'm going through and being like, oh, but that guy's going through. No, it's just, I think when there's perspective, you know, I think, and to acknowledge that actually being able to do everyday things is really a blessing.
Sure.
It really is.
Those are really awesome reflections, and thank you for sharing that. And if any of you guys want to listen to more of a story about what Solo has been through in the last 18 months, be sure to listen to the Halfway Up Middle podcast. Just search for it on Spotify, and Solo is, I think his episode is called The Warrior, and I think it's aptly named. Now, Solo, what's the earliest cricket childhood memory that you have?
So the first childhood memory has to be me playing driveway cricket every single day with my best friends from my junior school.
Okay.
And funny enough, I probably got into cricket because of them.
Oh.
You know, because when I was young, sort of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, I was a football soccer fanatic. And I just wanted to be a pro footballer. I was looking up to Louis Figo, you know, RG Shevchenko, Gattuso. You know, I really just wanted to be a footballer.
Yeah.
But as a result of my friends and my close circle, you know, at that age, you just become whatever everyone else is doing, you know. And my friends were, like, absolute cricket fanatics. And funny enough, like, after I started playing cricket, it was just, like, some kind of bug with me. And I couldn't stop, you know, and we were playing this drive. You know, when you take the ball to make it swing and the tennis ball, and sometimes you make it wet so it skips more. Like, all of those little things, it was absolutely amazing, you know. And you have to, if you hit the windows, you're out. You know,
six and out, buddy.
Yeah, you know, so I definitely cherish, you know, those moments and memories that I have, and actually have to thank my friends for the cricket career that I ended up having because of them,
So, Solo, what do you love the most about cricket?
I think because the game is so complex, you know, and it truly, you need to be a student of the game to play cricket. You can't just pick up and play, you know. You really have to understand the game, understand situations, so many different techniques to learn in terms of bowling, batting, so many different shots, so many different rules. You know, all the different equipment and gear we wear, it's such a complex sport. And it truly does prepare you for life in a way. Because if I can give you an example, you know, you could be training the week before a game, feeling like a million bucks, hitting the ball so well in the net, and you make off your first ball of the match, you know. and you were feeling like a million bucks before that. But now you were like on one high all the way to another low immediately. So it's such a good test of character and truly is a challenge. And that's why I love playing cricket, because I love competing and I love using strategy, you know, to overcome and to win. And I think cricket encapsulates all of those things that you need in order to become, you know, consistently a winner. Because essentially in cricket, you lose or you fail a lot more than you succeed. You know, you'll score 2-3 ducks and then a 20 and then you score your 100. You know, or you'll go 2-3 games without taking wickets and then you take a fiver. So by nature, it's set up for you to be mentally strong in order to be successful at the game. You really have to understand and accept that you will probably fail more than you succeed, you know.
Sure. Now, we're all living in the time of social distancing. We're in the midst of a epidemic, the coronavirus. You yourself are a survivor of the coronavirus. Now, as we're social distancing, people say out of sight, out of mind. How do you keep the love for the game alive in you in a time of isolation, in a time where you're not even where you're not even cleared right now to play?
Well, I've had a lot of practice with self-isolation since for the past year of my life. I was in the hospital room, so I had practice and I got ahead of the game before everybody else. But I think for me, you know, I just have this extreme hunger in that I'm not done, and I feel like I have unfinished business with cricket, you know. And this is one of the motivations that gets me up every single day, and it allows me to be able to go to therapy and do what I need to do, because truly, you know, it's not easy going to therapy 5 times a week for 2 hours a day, every single day, every single week, you know. But you find ways of motivating yourself to do what needs to be done. And I think because of this hunger that I have of feeling like I'm not done and that I have more to give, you know, to the game, and that I don't want to allow this disease and, you know, this pandemic and all that's happening on the outside world to derail where I was supposed to go in the game of cricket, you know, where I truly feel I was supposed to end up. And, you know, I feel like there's a lot more to give from me to the game.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that I'm not appreciative of what the game has been able to do for me over the past, you know, 8 years of being a pro, and, you know, before that playing schoolboy cricket. So it's I feel like I have a lot more to give, and that's what motivates me to keep going in this game. And, you know how it is with sports. You dedicate so much growing up. You sacrifice so much. You know, all the holidays we were friends were going on holidays and chilling with family. You were playing cricket tournaments in the sun, 30 degrees burning, you know, like trying to make a name for yourself and trying to win games. You know, you don't forget all of the little sacrifices you've made along the way. And for me, I just want to fulfill my potential, of which I don't think I've reached that final level as yet. So that's what keeps me going and keeps me ticking, and why I feel, you know, I have this hunger for this game still.
Thank you, bro. Thank you so much for that. I think your story in itself is a vehicle for hope, which is why sport is, when you do get back onto that field, it is it's not everything, it's not everything, but it is such an important vehicle for hope.
Honestly, even though if it's like a club game where no one's there, no one cares, I think I'll lose my heart, like, out of happiness. I promise you. I can't wait to just hit a cricket ball and hear that. Oh,
yes.
That's a bad. Oh my word! Like I'm frothing. I'm frothing.
Rugby World Cup winning captain Siya Kolisi was recently asked, "Was winning the Webb Ellis Trophy a catalyst for change in South Africa?" In his answer, Kolisi said, "Sport is not the answer. It's definitely not the answer, but it does bring people together in a way that little else does." Sia's right on both fronts. And I'll take it a step further and say sport gives us leverage. Leverage to inspire. Leverage to engage. Leverage to influence those who can make decisions for good. And at the very least, an excuse to give hope. Thank you for listening to this first episode of Falling in Sport. We'd like to hear your thoughts on what stood out for you and what's helped you fall in love with the game again. Also, if you're a die-hard fan of another sport and would like your voice featured in the memories and thoughts for upcoming episodes, you can send us an email at fallinginsport@gmail.com. On the next episode of Falling in Sport, we go to the court. To make sure you don't miss out on future episodes, subscribe to Falling in Sport on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and iono FM. Talk to you then.